Let me welcome Larry C. from Marietta, Ohio.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Cassidy, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 16th, 1987. I'm very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a home group that is the Williamstown Serenity Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Monday evenings at 7:30, and we read and study the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Wednesday evenings at 8 o'clock, and we read and we study the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first Monday of every month, we have an open meeting for anybody that's interested in our way of life. And we invite you to attend our meetings. Wow. Never been called a hero. But I have heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know what an honor it is. And I love AA. And I'm not just saying this because I'm here today, but I love Al-Anon. From the bottom of my heart, I love you for what you've done for me and my wife. I love you for the times that you took her into your meetings and you loved her. And you cared for her. And you understood her. And you hugged her. And you let her know that everything was going to be all right. And you let her know to keep coming back. Keep coming back. My sponsor, David, gave my wife a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, Paula, he said, read this. The first 164 pages, you might find something in there that's a benefit to you. And this is one of the things that she read. It's in the chapter to the wives. We urge you to try our program. For nothing will be so helpful to your husband as the radically changed attitude toward him, which God will show you how to have. That's us telling you, come in and try our 12 steps, and your life may be different. And on over in the book it talks about, even if your husband continues to drink, even if your family member continues to drink, even if your friend continues to drink, this may be of some benefit to you to apply these 12 steps. So glad Paula did it. You know, I'm not saying that alcoholics are incapable of love. And alcoholics, I'm not saying that they're incapable of understanding, because we are very understanding people, very loving, caring people. But when you're in the morass of alcoholism, you can't do that. You can't love somebody. I couldn't love myself. I hated me. I hated Al-Anon. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of those ones that if I seen a bumper sticker on somebody's car, a friend of Bill's, I'd flip him the bird. That's how bad I hated AA. Untreated alcoholism, selfishness and self-centered, self-will run riot, and drinking too. You know, Pat from Florida talks about this powerlessness over alcohol. Alcoholism is like having sex with a gorilla. You're not done till the gorilla says you are. By the time you realize that, it's gotcha. It's gotcha. And every time you start to think you're gaining control, you lose just a little more control. And before long, you realize that you're in self-pity, and that obsession that goes along with this illness, this disease, and incomprehensible demoralization is what they call it. And it's gotcha. And I want to leave you with this, that the way out of that begins when you accept the fact that it's gotcha. That's when it starts to begin to loosen the grip on you. That's when you begin to take a breath of relief, like when you finally accept the fact that it has you. Now, I admit that I had alcoholism long before I accepted the fact that alcoholism had me. Me and that gorilla wasn't going to stop at one time. But like I said, I want to thank you for what you've done for Paul and I. And, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I knew what this drinking was all about. I seen the fights, and I seen the knockdown, drag-out fights, and Mom and Dad coming home at 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning and taking us kids out of our beds and going to somebody else's house so they could party all night long and waking up at these people's houses. I didn't know who they were. And my brothers and I, we'd be trying to figure out, where do you go to catch a dust in this neighborhood? What are we supposed to do for lunch? You know, today they would probably be arrested for something like that. But back then you didn't talk about it. You know, you put the best, the cleanest, dirtiest clothes you got on and you go to school and you try to act like the tough guy. Larry, why are you late again? Larry, why do you talk like that? Why do you act like that? Why do you behave like that? And I didn't have an answer. I was different. Somebody gave everybody a book to life when they were born. And it was filled with directions. And by the time I opened mine up, the pages were blank. And I didn't know how to react. And I can remember my brothers and I, we would get together in the morning, and I'm talking to the kids, I'm talking 10, 11, 12 years old, and saying, what did you do to cause Mom and Dad to drink? Did you skip school today? Then it's your fault. That's why they're drunk. Did you steal again? It's your fault. That's why Dad hit me tonight when he came home drunk. I'm talking about alcoholism. I'm not talking about bad parents. I'm not talking about people incapable of loving. Talk about alcoholism at its worst. Everything says, Larry, don't drink. Don't drink. And I drank. My best friend, Kenny, he grew up in the, you know, and that's the only people I associated with was people that understood, the people that were like me. I didn't know that they were like me, but there was this attraction. And Kenny said, Larry, meet me down at the YMCA Saturday morning. We're going to play basketball. And we always played basketball every Saturday morning, it seemed. And this particular time, Kenny showed up and he had a bottle. And it was red. I don't know whether it was just regular wine or Wild Irish Rose or what. But it went down red and it came up red. And Kenny gave me a sip, and I took a sip, and then Kenny took a sip, and I took a sip, and then Kenny took a drink, and I took a drink, and that ease and comfort that's talked about in the doctor's opinion in the big book, that ease and comfort that comes after taking a few drinks, like, finally, that hole in the soul is filled. Finally, I opened my book, and there was the directions. You know, this disease, it's a spiritual malady. And somewhere, sometime in my life, something happened to me spiritually. And I'm not blaming anybody. But something happened. And my insides never matched your outsides. The way you looked was never the way I felt. And when I took this drink, I felt hope. And that you know, the big book talks about the feeling that we see others drinking with impunity. And I had to look that up in the dictionary, and it's you see others drinking without any problems. And I couldn't identify to that day, but later on in my life I could identify to that. That, you know, what are you doing today, Joe? Oh, I'm going to have a beer and then I'm going to go home and cut the grass. And then 10 minutes later you say, well, where's Joe? Well, he went home to cut the grass. Well, how could he do that? How could he do that? Why would he do that? It's just getting started. Joe was one of those ones that could drink with impunity. I couldn't do that. Paula can do that. I can't do that. Some of you Al-Anons can do that. Some of you Al-Anons ought not drink, I'll tell you that. But anyhow, the next Monday at school, I remember I passed a note to Kenny, and I talked to Kenny just the other day. Kenny and I are still close friends. He lives in Columbus, Ohio. I live in Marietta. And I asked him, do you remember that Monday in school when I sent you the note? And he knew what I was talking about. He said, about drinking. I said, yeah. And on that note, it said, Kenny, when do you think we can drink again? I found my solution. I didn't care whether Mom and Dad drank anymore. I didn't care whether they come home drunk fighting. I didn't care if my tennis shoes had holes in them. I didn't care if I had to wear my brother's pants. I didn't care if my shirt was dirty or if my hair was greasy. I had found my solution. And that's the way Kenny and I acted, and that's the way we behaved. And we would borrow all week long at school, bum money off kids. And on the weekends, we would get down under the train bridge in Marietta, and we would get a wino. We'd buy him a bottle and buy us some. And we would go to the high school dance or the junior high dance, and we would act like, you know, if we had a six-pack, Kenny would drink three, and I'd drink three. And the kids at school the next day would say, "God, you guys were really bomb last night. How much did you drink?" And I'd say, "A case of beer." Kenny would say, "Oh, no, it wasn't a case. It was a case and a fifth, you know." And then later on, you know, I come home after being out for two or three days, and Paula meets me at the door and says, "How much did you have to drink?" And I'd say, "Three beers." We lie about it. And we begin to live that lie. And after a while, that lie becomes a normal way of life. And then after a while, I don't know when I'm lying and when I'm telling the truth. The abnormality of it becomes normal. And then I don't know anything else. And all I know is drink. All I know is that alcohol makes me feel better than anything ever made me feel in my life. And the sad thing about that, as good as it made me feel, I wanted more. I wanted more. That feeling was, and it became elusive. And every time I drank, that's what I wanted. And it wasn't long, you know, you can't grow up living a life like that without getting in trouble. And I was in trouble all the time. And my principal called me into school one day, and he said, "Larry," he said, "you know what?" First, he was on the telephone, he was talking to somebody, and he said, "No, we're tired of dealing with it. He's gone. He's history. Don't want it anymore. Not going to put up with it anymore." And he hung up, and he just sat there and stared at me for what seemed like an eternity. And he said, "Larry, do you know what?" And I said, "What?" He said, "Do you know who I was talking to?" And I said, "No." I said, "But somebody's in trouble, aren't they?" He said, "Yes." He said, "It's you." He said, "I was just talking to your mother, Larry. And you see, my mother and father are binge drinkers. And when they wasn't drinking, they wanted to do everything right. When they wasn't drinking, they was Mr. and Mrs. Brady." That's the truth. When they wasn't drinking, they could be depended on. When they wasn't drinking, they were loving. When they wasn't drinking, they was caring. And this is one of those times when my mother wasn't drinking and she was worried about me. By this time, I was coming home drunk. By this time, I was going to school drunk. And the principal said, "Larry," he said, "we was just going to get rid of you, fail you, and get you out of our hair." He said, "We're going to give you a chance. You come to school," and this was like April, "you come to school the rest of the year, April or May, and you can graduate. You just go to suspension hall. Don't bring no pen, no paper, no pencil, no nothing. Just come in and put your head down, and don't bother nobody. And we're going to graduate you. We don't want you back here, ever." Yeah. Everything I wanted. A place to go to pass out. That's what I thought. The day I turned 18 years old, I went up to my father and I said, "Look," I said, "you know, you've had a chance to make something out of our name and you failed. And I'm going to do that." And I proceeded to tell Dad what a bad person he was. And I looked over at Mom and I told her all the wrong things that she'd done too. And I said, "I'm out of here. I'm going to make something of this name." And I throwed all my clothes in a garbage bag. Big hefty garbage bag. Out the door I went to make something out of my name. First place I went to Kenny's, knocked on the door. "Kenny, hey buddy, I need a place to stay." Kenny and I made a deal. "You watch my back, I'll watch your back. If you ever need me, I'll be there. If I ever need you, you be there. All right. Come on in, Larry. You can stay here as long as you want." Kenny was married at the time. His wife was pregnant. 2 weeks later, Kenny said, "Larry, you got to go." I said, "What do you mean I got to go? Oh, you're coming home drunk. You're putting stuff in the oven, Larry, and you turn the oven on, you pass out. You're passing out with cigarettes in your hand. You burn a hole in the chair. You want to fight me, your best friend, when you're drinking. I can't have that. My wife can't have that, Larry. She's pregnant. You got to go. I love you. But you got to go." "Kenny, don't worry about it. No problem." So I throw my clothes in the garbage bag, some of Kenny's clothes in the garbage bag, and downtown I went. And I ran into Chuck. Larry, how you doing? I said, you're not going to believe this. Kenny, of all people, turned wuss on me. What do you mean? I said, he threw me out. What for? I said, no reason at all. He didn't even give me a chance to find a job to help pay my way. I said, it's that wife. That's what it is. Well, come on over and stay with me. My parents, they won't care. It wasn't but a week later. Larry, you got to go. Mom and Dad can't put up with your craziness. Dad had to step over you on the front porch to go to work this morning. We can't have that. The neighbors are going to start talking. You've already busted a window. You broke the window to try to get in the door, Larry. You're drunk. We can't have that. This is the way it went. It seemed like, and what I found out that I was doing is I was burning bridges behind me and didn't realize it. I didn't know that at a certain time in my life, it seemed like every time I had to go to one of these people for help for something, and they had already had enough of it. And I began to hear, Larry, you're a bum. You're no good. Stay away from me. Things come up missing when you're around me. Clothes come up missing when you're around me. You're a drunk, Larry. And, you know, I'm talking about 18, 19 years old. And I used to tell people that I lived on the riverbank. And my sponsor came up to me after a meeting once and he said, "Ah, you didn't ever tell me you lived on the riverbank." And I said, "Well, David didn't actually live on the riverbank. I stayed on the riverbank for a while." "Oh, okay." Yeah, you'll lead again. He came up to me after that lead and he said, "Well, just how long did you stay on the riverbank?" And I said, "Well, a few hours." "A few hours?" I said, "Well, yeah." I said, didn't have no place to go one day, and I was sitting down on the riverbank, and this couple came down, and the lady's name was Ruth, and her husband was named Clarence, and Ruth said, Clarence was Chuck's brother. Ruth said, "Larry, how's it going?" I said, "Oh, bad, bad. I ain't got no place to stay. I'm hungry. Nothing, you know, nothing to do. Nobody will give me a chance. Can't find a job. Clarence, you got anything to drink?" Ruth said, "Larry, if you could have anything in the world right now, what would it be?" And I said, "Are you serious?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Pork chops, mashed potatoes, and gravy. And a big glass of milk." You know, these acts of kindness that people showed me all my life, just phenomenal. She left and she came back about an hour later and she said, "Clarence, bring Larry up to the trailer." And she slid open that sliding glass door of that trailer and there was everything I said I wanted to eat. Pork chops and mashed potatoes and gravy and a big thing of milk and rolls. And God, it took them almost 2 years to get rid of me. They lived in this big long trailer and they just took in strays. At one time, there had to have been 10 to 15 people living there. And if you can imagine, you know, we all put our checks together at the first of the month. Most of them was on welfare or some kind of support or whatever. And I don't know where, but we were getting money. We were getting food stamps. And we would go out and we would buy cases of Spam and macaroni and cheese. And then they'd give me some of those food stamps and I'd take them downtown and I'd cash them in for dollars. And I'd go buy whiskey and wine and beer for us. And the first 2-3 weeks of the month, God, we lived great. Spam and macaroni and booze. And you know, it came the time when Clarence had to say, "Larry, buddy, you've got to go." And you know, I hung on there as long as I could because of Ruth. Ruth loved me. And I love Ruth. She damn near killed me loving me. She did. Almost loved me to death. Ruth is like Roseanne of that, what was the name of that show? What? Yeah, Roseanne. she looked like her, was her size, and Clarence looked like Dan, was as big as Dan, and that was them. That was them to the T. And, you know, Ruth just, and thank God for these steps when I was able to go back and make amends to her and her husband for the things that I'd done and said and the way that I lied and cheated and stole off of them. And Ruth said, "You know, Larry," she said, "I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know what it was." But anyhow, they told me I had to go, and Clarence said, "We're going away for the weekend. When we get back, you better be going." And there was no arguing with Clarence. I said, "All right, I'm out of here." But I wanted to have a big party before I went, so I called Kenny, and I said, "Kenny, I'm having a going away party." He said, "Where are you moving to?" I said, "Well, I haven't found a place yet."
He said, don't even ask. I said, come on over. I said, we're going to have a party. And he said, do you mind if my wife's sister comes over tonight? And I said, no, the more the merrier. I said, just make sure she brings something to drink. So we're sitting there at this trailer, and we're drinking, a few of us, and a knock on the door, and I open up the door, and there's Paula. And I take a look at Paula, and I take a look at the one that I'm with, and I think, God, I've made a mistake. Horrible mistake here. I don't want her. I want her. And I looked outside at this car that Paula pulled up in, and it had these great big mag wheels and this real shiny, and it was all humped up in the back like that. And I thought, God, look at that car. I said, Kenny, come here a minute. I said, look at her car. Oh, yeah. He said, that's nice. And I said, yeah. And it was parked right in front of mine. And mine had the dents and the busted window and the low tires, you know, the alcoholic car. And she went over and she sat down beside her sister, and I heard her say something about putting money in the bank. And I thought, God, this woman's got money in the bank. I'd never met anybody in my life that had a bank account. And I started doing what we do. You know, if you don't want to be with the one you're with, you start causing trouble, they get mad and leave, and then you start hitting on the other. And by this time, we're at another party, and I'm giving Paula all these sad sob stories, you know, I ain't got nowhere to go and this and that. And my girlfriend gets mad, and she leaves, and Paula's driving me all over Marietta to try to find a place for me to live or a place for me to stay. And finally, we come to my aunt's house, and after a couple hours, she says, you've got to get out of my car. She said, I got to get up and go to work. God, I loved hearing her say that. This woman works. I'd never had a girlfriend that worked. I hardly worked. But I told her, I said, look, I said, I work at a car dealership. I said, and before I told her this, I said, I love you, and I'm going to marry you. And she said, get out. You're crazy. Get out. Same thing her mother said in the kitchen when I told her mother I was going to marry her. Get out. You're crazy. Don't ever bring this up again. Don't ever bring this up when my husband's home. He was out of town. He's an iron worker. Don't ever bring it up when Paul comes home. But Paula said, get out. I said, I'll tell you what. I said, if you love me, now we've known each other about 4 hours. If you love me, I get off work at 5 o'clock tomorrow. I wash cars down the road. And this qualifies her for the program of Al-Anon. She was there at 4:30. I'm sending guys outside. Hey, my fiance just pulled up. Your fiance? Yeah, yeah. Well, Larry, how long have you been engaged? I said, oh, well, we just met last night. And they said, Larry, it don't work. It don't work like that. And I said, yeah, it does. I said, go out there. I said, she just pulled in. Look at her car. It's the truth. I sat down with Paul and I wrote it out on paper. You take the money that you make and the money you've got in the bank and the money that I hope to make someday and the money I hope to put in the bank, and we can buy a house. We can get married. I never drink again. Everything will be okay. She said yes. She said yes. She bought it. She bought it. Had a harder time selling it to her family. Within a year, Paul and I was married. I promised her mother, I will love your daughter and I will take care of her, and she will never want for anything. And we wasn't married 24 hours. Wasn't 24 hours after I said I do, I was knocking on her mom's back door wanting to know if she had $50 so we could go to the grocery store. The money that we had put back for groceries, I had spent the night that we got married to get drunk. And for a long time, I thought we had the most romantic, erotic wedding night ever. And I think I found out down here at the winter conference once when Paula was given a lead that we didn't do anything. But I'd promised Paula that I'd never drink again, and after about 2 weeks of trying to not drink, I couldn't handle it. And I brought a 12-pack home, and she got. I seen that fear in her face, and I thought, why is she so scared? But I went in, and I just started dumping that 12-pack out. Paula said, Larry, I don't care if you drink. Whoa. If you can just drink one or two. No problem, Paula. Downtown I went. I don't know when I came back that night or next day. But, you know, it was on. I was gone. Alcoholism, once again. A couple of weeks later, I'm at a party, and this guy says, you know, hey, I just heard you got married. Yeah, who'd you marry? I said, well, Paula Brown from Williamstown. Hey, I know Paula. She's a nice girl. You're a lucky guy. I went to school with Paula. Very nice. Nice family. Yeah, okay. So I'm sitting there drinking, and I don't know if you guys are like I am. I know some alcoholics are. The more I drank, what this guy said and what I heard became two different things. After a few drinks, what I heard him say, I've been with your wife. I've had your wife. You're no good. Waiting for you to pass out. You pass out, I'm going home to your wife. Now, this guy hadn't said anything else to me. I get up and I walk over to him and say, outside. He said, what? I said, I know what's going on. He said, buddy, you're crazy. Leave me alone. So I went home and I busted in. We lived in a half a trailer. We didn't live in a whole trailer, half a trailer. You walk in and you're in the front room, dining room, and kitchen. If you look to the right, you see the bathroom. You look to the left, you see the bedroom. That's what we lived in. And I go busting in that bedroom door, and I flip the bed over on top of Paula, and I start to tell her all the nasty things, how bad a person she is. How could you have an affair on me? We haven't even been married a month. How could you do that to me? You're no good. And start calling her all these names. And I'd like to tell you that she told me what happened the next morning, and I thought, my God, I'll never do that again. The thought was there, but I couldn't not do that. I couldn't not drink. And a few weeks later, a few days later, I'd come home and Paula would be sitting there and she'd have a bruise on the side of her leg and I'd say, what happened to you? Don't you know? Don't you realize what you're doing? What's going on? Larry, when you come home, you knock me over the coffee table for no reason at all. You ask me to fix you something to eat and then you slap me. I didn't know about blackout drinking. I didn't know that after I drank so long that I was not going to realize what was happening or what was going to take place. I just knew that every time I drink, I didn't want to be the way it was the time before. I just knew that this time it's going to be different. This time we're going to have a good time. Paula, you want to go out tonight? Yeah, we're going to have a good time. And then the next day to see her with a black eye or a bruise. And I'm telling you, nobody could hate me any worse than I hated myself. Thank God for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I realize I'm supposed to be held accountable for my actions. You people showed me that. You people taught me that. But that ninth step where I'm able to go to my wife and sincerely make amends for the harms that I've done. And when I talk about making amends, I'm talking about repairing the damage. I'm talking about trying to take a relationship and make it finer than it ever was before. I'm not talking about saying I'm sorry. David told me once, he said, Larry, he said, if you come by and you break my window, and then you come by the next day and say, Dave, I broke your window, he said, you're acknowledging that you've done the damage. He said, there's no amends there. He said, you're probably telling me something I already knew. He said, but if you come by the next day and say, Dave, I got a plate of glass with me, you know, I'm the one that broke your window. And I need to let you know that I'm here to repair that. And you put that plate of glass of window in there and you clean up the mess that you made, then you've made your amends. Thank God for that. Thank God that I'm able to do that with Paula. A day at a time. And when I came to that process of the steps, working through the steps with my sponsor, and I came to that ninth step and I said, David, how can I go to her and tell her that I'm sorry again? She's tired of hearing that. He said, go and repair the damage. And my amends to my wife is today, and I told her, I said, Paula, I will simply love you more today than I did yesterday. And that's my amends. And that's how I try to continue my amends tomorrow. And I'm telling you, it's not always easy. I don't always feel loving. You know, Paul and I, we don't believe we have a 50-50 relationship. It's not you work your program and I'll work my program. That's bull. That's crap. There's no 50-50. It's not you do this and I'll do that. It can't be. Sometimes I don't have 50% to put into my relationship with my wife. Sometimes I've only got 40%. And Paula has to pick up the extra 10% and carry the load. Sometimes Paula doesn't have 50%, and she can only put in 40%, and I have to pick up the extra and carry the load. That's what a loving relationship's all about. My relationship with Paula has nothing to do with Paula. It has everything to do with me and my relationship with God as I understand Him. When my relationship with God is right, my relationship with the whole world is right. I believe that today. When I don't have it to put in and she don't have it to put in, we turn to God. And we've never been let down yet. Not one time has Paul and I ever went to God with a problem, but what it wasn't taken care of. Not when I wanted it to, but it was taken care of. And sometimes I call Dave and say, Dave, the answer's not coming.
This is the end of side one. Stop your recorder now and turn the tape over.
Wait. What do I do when I'm waiting? Don't do what you want to do. Well, what do I do? Do what you don't want to do. Well, what's that, Dave? Sometimes he has to tell me what I want to do. Get a hold of somebody and take them to a meeting, Larry. Call somebody up. Get out of yourself. Do something for your wife. You know, Dave and I were sitting outside in this. By this time, Paul and I lived in a little 2-3-bedroom apartment. And I'm sitting outside with David. And I said, you know, Dave, I said, she's going to leave me. I know it. She don't like me. And I don't think I like her. You know, what can I do? And he said, well, why don't you go in there and do something nice for her? How long have you been married? By this time, it was like 9 years, 10 years. He said, well, go in and do something nice for her. And I said, what do you want me to do? He said, go in and do the dishes. I said, do the dishes? He said, yeah. Well, you know, this is like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and we had already been. And I knew by then, Paula's already got the dishes done. I said, well, okay, Dave, I'll do that. So I get out of the pickup truck and I run in there and open up the door and I look in the kitchen and hell, the sink's full of dishes. I went into Paula in the bedroom and I said, I know what you're up to. She said, what are you talking about? And I said, you and Dave, this business on the side to get me to clean the house. I said, I'm not going to put up with that. You know, before Dave came into my life, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. And I want to tell you, that was a very bad 5 years. And you, by this time, Paula had come to grips with her suffering of the illness. And she just had 17 years, July 9th, July 8th. She just had 17 years in the program of Al-Anon. And when I was telling somebody that at a meeting, they said, oh, your drinking finally ran her to Al-Anon. And I said, no. My drinking didn't have nothing to do with Paula going to Al-Anon. She was suffering from untreated alcoholism. She was suffering from her own untreated alcoholism. That's what took her to Al-Anon. She went and got her driver's license that day. And on her driver's license, and you know, our pictures don't look that good anyhow on our driver's license. But that particular day, Paula looked at that picture, and she said it looked like somebody dead. And she thought, my God, I need to go to Al-Anon. I need to get back to Al-Anon. And when she went back to Al-Anon, she set me down that next day and she said, I'm going to tell you something. This is what I'm going to put up with and this is what I'm not going to put up with. And she set down the rules. I'd heard it before. But I didn't know that finally somebody had got into her head and say what you mean what you say. And she would go to these Al-Anon meetings, and I would stand, and I shared this morning in the meeting, I would stand in front of the door of that apartment, you know, I'm drunk, I'm drinking. And I would dare her. I dare you to try to go to your Al-Anon meeting tonight. You just try it. I'll knock the crap right out of you. And the longer I'd stand, the drunker I got, I'd pass out and I'd slide down the door and I'd feel one leg get up like this, and the other leg up like that, and I could feel her dragging me across the floor to go to the Al-Anon meeting. What lengths will we go to? Will we put our lives in jeopardy? And she was willing to do that. Now, while she was going to these Al-Anon meetings, I was sure that somebody was seeing her because she began to change. And she seemed like she was happier than she ever had been. And I thought, she's seeing somebody.
I don't know who he is, but he's making Rocco happy. And I'd go, I'd follow her to these Al-Anon meetings. There was a city park right across from her home group, and there's all these trees, and I'd be standing there. Watching her. See who she was going to talk to. Because I just knew that she was seeing somebody. And this happened week after week after week. Stand outside, there he is. It's got to be him. It's got to be him. And the guy'd walk right by. Ah, they know I'm over here. They're not going to meet tonight. They'll meet Tuesday night in Parkersburg or whatever. And I'd follow her to these meetings. And she started bringing home these bank bags. Now, I'm taking a big chance here. But I want you to know that there's members of Paula's home group here. And I've already been there and I've already made amends for this. All right? But she was bringing home these blue bank bags. And they had all these $1 bills in them. Now, I'd been to enough meetings to know that they pass a basket. And I knew that she must have became the treasure to this group. And I'm going to show them, try to fix my wife up with somebody, huh? I'll break you. And I'd take all them ones, and I'd run down to Jim and Jimmy's, and I'd get drunk on Al-Anon's money. I'm not talking once. I'm not talking twice. I don't know how many times. And I would laugh all the way down to the bar. I'll show them. And I want you to know that I've made amends to that group for taking that money. And I've paid them back. I don't know how much money I've given them back. But I can assure you this, I can promise you this. It was more than I took. It was more than I took. I have a great love for Al-Anon. David began to help me with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and began to walk me through the steps. And we begin this relationship. And we were sitting outside the truck one night, and he said, Larry, what's the worst thing you've ever done? And I said, Dave, I said, I'm no idiot. I am not going to tell you the worst thing I've ever done. I had never even told Kenny the worst thing I'd ever done. Nobody. I was taking that to the grave with me. He said, well, let me tell you the worst thing I've ever done. I said, okay, if you feel comfortable with that. And he proceeded to tell me this stuff that he was involved in when he was drinking. And I just sat there and said, okay, that's all right. And I got out of that car as quickly and as quietly as I could. And I ran in the house and I told Paula, I said, that SOB's crazy. And she said, who? I said, David. She said, well, what did he do? And I said, I can't tell you. If he knows I told you, he'll probably kill me. And what he was doing is he was trying to share a part of him to get my trust. And the more David did that, the more I began to say, okay. The more I began to say, yes, that's me. The more I began to say, God, there might be hope for me. And the more David shared, you know, when I got out of treatment, they said, call your sponsor. I called him and I said, all right, David, what do I do? And he said, Larry, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and call me when you're done. And I did that. And I said, all right, David, now what do I do? He said, Larry, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and call me when you're done. I said, that's no problem. I'll do that. I read him and I called him and I said, David, now what do I do? I'm ready. He said, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and call me when you're done. And I don't know if this happened for 6 months or 6 years, but it seemed like every time I talked to Dave, that was his solution to all my problems. Read the first 164 pages of Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and call me when you're done. But see, in between these readings, in between me going home and sitting on the front porch and reading that first 164 pages, or sitting in my bed at night when I'm going to bed reading that, or sitting in the bathroom reading it, or wherever it was, in between these readings, David was being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. He was 12-stepping me. He was carrying me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was showing me by his example of how to get sober. He was showing me by his example of how to be happy, joyous, and free. And I wanted so much what David had. I wanted so much what he had. He said, Larry, if you want what I got, you'll do what I did to get it. And I trusted him and I believed him. And if I seen David put cream in his coffee, I put cream in my coffee. David smoked a pipe. I quit smoking cigarettes and started smoking a pipe. David had a little pickup truck. I got a little pickup truck.
You know, it's just whatever David did, I did. And until I learned that I couldn't stay sober just by doing what he did, I had to take the action of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Paul and I, we used to go to meetings with a group of people and you know, we would go bowling afterwards. Bowling! And I hated them people. And I would bitch all the way there and bitch all the way home. And, you know, they're cheating. Did you see them keeping score? They didn't keep score right. They cheated. You know, spiritual giants, my foot. And I'd go get drunk. Or we'd play Trivial Pursuit. Oh, they're cheating, Paul. I'll never go back there again. And I'd go get drunk. And at one of these parties, it was a lady from Al-Anon and called, and I'd picked up the phone. She was calling to speak to Paul. She said, well, since I got you on the phone, Larry, I just want to invite you and your wife to our New Year's Eve party. I said, oh, okay, yeah, well, that'd be nice. Finally feeling like I'm starting to fit in this deal. And we go out there, and there's all the Al-Anons in there in the kitchen, and they're just laughing and joking and having a good time. There's all the AAs over in that corner, and then there's me in this corner. I know what they're doing. They've got with Paul, and they said, we know that you're worried about him drinking on New Year's Eve, so we'll just have a party. That way you can keep an eye on him, and we'll know where he's at. All right? And I went up to Paul after we on the way home that night, and I said, look, I said, that'll never happen again. I said, I know what you guys are all about. You're not going to ruin my drinking. Next year, I'm going to drink on New Year's Eve. Next year. The next day, I was drunk. You know, everybody was out to get me. The very next day, I was drunk. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get this. In and out of meetings, I had all the answers. And it's all right to have all the answers. But the problem is, from the point that you have all the answers, you can't learn a damn thing. I was unteachable. And it took the patience and the persistence of Alcoholics Anonymous to help me. You know, they would say, Larry, keep coming back. And I think, how can they invite me back? How can they ask me to come back? You know, I was the one that I came in late and left early. And I talked when the speaker was talking. And I talked when they were going around the table talking. And I was very disruptive. Paula refused to go to some of the open meetings with me because I throw paper wads at people. And they would tell me to keep coming back. I'll tell you what, don't think I'm not grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. For the patience and tolerance and the understanding that those people showed me. You know, there's been times I've asked people to leave meetings. Sometimes I need to be remembered of what I was like and what happened to me and what it's like today. You know, the very first open meeting, and I know I'm jumping around a lot, but the very first open meeting that Paul and I went to together, when it came her turn to talk, I said, whoa, no. I said, she's not one of us. She drinks, but she's not one of us. I said, she don't know. She don't know what's going on here. I said, I just got out of a 28-day program, and I've got the equivalency to 2 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the honest to God's truth. Arrogant. Arrogant. That arrogant doesn't stop when I stop drinking, you know. Being irresponsible doesn't stop when I stop drinking. I was talking a little bit about over there at the meeting this morning, and I could identify with it. Because I can remember coming home and Paul saying, Larry, we've got $3 till payday. What are we going to do? And I'd say, I'm not drinking. But they'd call me into work and they'd say, you're late again. You're late one more time and you're fired. And I'd say, I'm not drinking. My mom would say, I heard some things about you again, Larry. And I'd say, Mom, I'm not drinking. I thought that was the problem. I didn't know that that was just a symptom of the problem. I didn't know that the 12 steps would help show me how to be a more responsible person, how to be a better husband, how to be a better son, and how to show up at work on time. Thank God for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One night, David said, Larry, he said, we're going to go to a different type of meeting tonight. And I said, what is that? He said, it's a district meeting. I said, all right. So we went to this district meeting, and I had no clue what was going on. And they was talking about the business aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I liked that. And I went out and I started a group so I could be a GSR so I could go and be, represent a group at that district meeting. And things was going so good at that group, I started another one. It was a franchise. It was a Saturday morning group. And then I opened up one on Thursday night. And the attendance was great, but I could never get anybody to show up at the group conscious meetings. And by this time, my dad was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, "Dad, I don't understand these people in AA." I said, "Look," I said, "I got two meetings going. I said, I got plenty of money. We're collecting great, you know, a great amount of money. Got big books." He said, "Larry," he said, "I'm glad you brought this up." He said, "I've been wanting to tell you this for a long time." He said, "People don't like you." I said, "What do you mean they don't like me?" He said, "You're running them off." He said, "People don't like it when you stand at the door and say who can come in and who can't. People don't like it when you tell them what you're going to do with the money. People don't like it when you tell them how you're going to run the group." He said, "You need to lighten the load a little bit. Let some other people participate." I went to David. I said, "Dave," I said, "you know, I've been to that district meeting. I know all this about AA now." I said, "I'm a GSR of this group, and I'm the secretary of that group." I said, "I joined another group on Friday night, the speaker meeting." I said, "I'm thinking about being the treasurer of that group." And David looked at me and he said, "You know, Larry, it gets tough being Mr. AA." I said, "You're no help." And I went in and I told Paul, and this is honest to God's truth. I went in and I told Paul, I said, "Paul, David's got severe problems." And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said, "I'm trying to lay this, all this stuff that's going on to David, and he looks at me," I said, "and he's having trouble being Mr. AA. He thinks he's Mr. AA." And she said, "Larry, you've missed it." She said, "I think he might have been talking about you." I said, "Oh my God." A couple of weeks later, some ladies came up to me and they said, "Larry," said, "would you let us take over that group?" "Yeah, but it won't last." You know, the very last thing I gave them for that group, I gave them all the books, all the literature, the keys, the coffee pots, the coffee, the cream, the sugar, the money. I wasn't going to give them the money. That was my money. Finally, one of them come up and they said, "Come on, we need that money. We need that money that's been collected in the baskets." "Oh, okay. I'll give it to them." I didn't keep it. A delegate came out of that group for the state of Ohio. A delegate. And I almost killed that meeting by not following the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what can happen when you let somebody's ego take over your group. The traditions go out the door and it begins to run itself into the ground. So thank God for the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're what hold that group together. The 12 traditions deal with people like me. If you are a member of a group and you are working, your group is working the 12 traditions, when an idiot like me shows up, don't worry about it. The traditions will take care of it. And if you have a drunk show up and he's throwing paper wads and he's causing discord and unharmony in your group, pray for him. Because 10 years down the road, he could be the delegate for your state. They took me to an assembly, and it was a voting assembly. And I ran to the phone that night. Well, after they voted all the officers in that day, I ran to the phone that night, and the guy that got elected chairman of the area for West Virginia called me over that night, and he said, "Won't you sit down here beside me?" He sat in the front row. I love people that sit in the front row. He sat in the front row, and he said, "Sit down here beside me." And the speaker was a guest from the General Service Office. And I ran to the phone that night, and I was crying. And I told Paul, I said, "You're not going to believe it." I said, "But today we elected the president of Alcoholics Anonymous in West Virginia." And she said, no, Larry, no. She said, "They don't elect presidents in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "See?" I said, "There you go. You're trying to ruin it again." I said, "We did. I said, I was there. I voted for the guy. And he asked me to sit beside him tonight, Paul. He had a suit on." And she said, "Well, grab David and talk to him." And I went and I talked to David, and David said, "No, Larry, we elected a chairperson today. That's what that process was all about." And then, you know, and that day I'd filled out like 5 votes and put them in the basket, and David grabbed them votes out. He said, "We don't do that. One vote, Larry. One voice, one vote for one group." I said, David, I said, they got up, they went to the bathroom. Somebody's got to vote for them. He said, if they get up and go to the bathroom, their group will deal with that for them not placing their vote in. He said, but that's none of your business. A few years down the road, I stay very active in service. There is no recovery without service in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. A few years down the road, they elect me delegate for the area of West Virginia to go to the General Service Conference and represent the voice of AA in West Virginia. And I run to the phone that night, and I cried. And I told Paul, I said, you're not going to believe it, but they elected me delegate. And she said, Larry, go get a newcomer and ask him to sit beside you tonight and leave your suit on. And that's exactly what I did. And I went and I found one of the newest GSRs that was there at the assembly that day, and I asked him to sit with me. I think I felt prouder to have this newcomer sit with me than he did for me to sit with him. And, you know, you people have given us that. You people have given Paul and I the compassion, the understanding that we need to live one day at a time. And we went to New York, and I got to sit there at the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they called out West Virginia. And God, I'm crying. And I stand up and say, here. And then, you know, we go through the process of voting, and it's like I look at this delegate, and he's got tears coming down his eyes, and the delegate over here, you know, we're voting, and he's crying, and I'm crying, and we're just voting on whether we're going to smoke during the conference or not. We were overwhelmed with joy and happiness. And you talk about an ultimate responsibility. The toughest thing I had to do was go to the microphone and voice my unpopular voice on something that they was going to take place at the conference that year. It's when they was wanting to come in and video the conference. And I said, you can't bring cameras in here. And they said, it'll help the groups. It'll help them see what goes on at the conference. And I said, well, how's that going to help the guy down on the corner? Please don't bring cameras in here. You know, they had voted like 100 and some to 7 or 8 to do it. And somebody heard me and they said, wait a minute, this guy might have a point. Don't do that. We can't be videotaping this. And thank goodness they didn't do it. You know, I could hear the rumblings from the meetings in the sky. We need to protect the anonymity of our members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's not just what's going to happen today, it's what's going to happen 20 years down the road. The decisions we make today will affect Alcoholics Anonymous 20 years down the road. Take heed to the traditions. I'm going to try and wrap this up. Paul and I, we pulled up to a stop sign. And we was going to go to her grandmother's. You know, we live in a small town, it's not hard to get there. And she turned her blinker on to go left, and I said, why are you going left? It's faster that way. I said, no, go right. I don't want to go right. I said, go right, it's faster. We're going left. And we got into almost a knockdown, drag-out fight right there. We couldn't figure out which way to go. See, it's to us, it's like, it's not enjoying the journey, it's let's get there. And it's the same way with this program. Slow down a little bit. Enjoy the journey. It's not a matter of when you're going to get there. The last year that I was delegate, Paula was first year delegate for Al-Anon for the state of West Virginia. And she called me up in my hotel room that night. She's down at her conference at Hampton, Virginia Beach. And I'm up at New York. And she said, Larry, you're not going to believe some of the decisions that we made today. It's going to affect Al-Anon worldwide. And I said, my God, Paul, I'm feeling the same way about the decisions we made about Al-Anon. About AA. I was just thinking about that. Now, you're taking two people that can't decide whether to go left or right at a stop sign. And the worst part about it is we knew where we was going. It's a miracle. Alcoholics Anonymous is a miracle. The program of Al-Anon is a miracle. I want to tell you, I didn't come running back to Alcoholics Anonymous because of anything I'd heard in an AA meeting. I didn't come running back to Alcoholics Anonymous because of anything my sponsor had said to me, because of anything any spiritual giant had said to me, because of a judge, because of a jury, because of a counselor, a priest, minister, a rabbi. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I seen the change in that woman right there. I seen that glow in her eyes. I seen that happiness start to unfold in her life, and I wanted what she had. And I called her that night and I said, Paula, for God's sake, I need help. And she said, Larry, if you want to get sober, you come home. Get a cab and come home. Thank God for you people in Al-Anon that gave her that compassion and that understanding. A couple years after I'd been sober, I celebrated a birthday, a regular birthday. And Paula's mother gave me a birthday card. Now, this was the woman that seen the abuse, that seen the bruises, that had to bail us out one time after another. And this is what the card said. It said, Larry, happy birthday. Remember the old saying, you've come a long way, baby? I guess that was written for women, but would it have to apply to you too? I am so proud of you. And I'm sure that AA would be the major factor in your lifestyle today. I know that it has been a battle for you, and as far as I'm concerned, you sure have made it. Now, see, she thinks I got it made. She does. And I'm not going to tell her any different. What's important for me to do is to let you people know that I know I don't have it made. I don't. I'm the furthest one probably in this room from having it made. My sobriety is contingent on the spiritual program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the action I take to enhance that. But this is the part I read that made me cry like a baby. Thanks for all the good things you've done for my daughter. The good things. She was able to look past all that. That's not saying a damn thing about Larry Cassidy. That's saying everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's saying everything about the program of Al-Anon. And I want to thank you people for that from the bottom of my heart. And, you know, I could go on forever with the gratitude that I have for you people. But I just want you to know that every night when I go to bed, I thank God. I thank God for Al-Anon. I really do. I got friends here from Pittsburgh. I was sitting in a meeting one night, and we was talking about doing the third step and how Paul and I had done the third step. And it just seemed like when you do it with another person, there's something more added to it. And the ladies from Pittsburgh done the third step that night, and I said, well, you can't, that won't work unless you come back next year and do it again. And they've been coming back every year for how many years? Five, six? Several years. Every Saturday night after the speaker meeting, you can find them over there in the chapel kneeling down doing the third step prayer. And I'll be there with them tonight. And that's a gift that you people, that's just added gift that you people have given us. I want to thank you for that. Thank you for allowing Paul and I to be here. Thank you for allowing Paul and I to be a part of your lives.